Welcome everybody to the September 22nd. Planning commission work. Now we have a guest host tonight. Beloved city manager, who's raising us, taking Derek's place. I think Derek's starting to tie with him for all of you. Anyhow, we'll do a roll call.
That's I figured.
Mr. Bear?
Here.
Mr. Rolio, who's not here.
Excuse.
He's excused.
Mr. Michigan State?
Yeah.
You're one track.
Green white here.
Green white here, I'm here. Bob's here.
Yeah.
And Mr. Francisco?
I'm shocked here.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I don't want to forget, Mr. Hawaii himself. Oh, yeah. He's not here. Mr. East, semi-noted that I saw him saying he's not going to make it.
Yeah.
However, we do have a forum, so the... So we did call to order. Next, we have new business. I assume that we can move on to item number 2.A, the coastal dune hazard map updates.
Yes, and we have with us today John here in person in Chambers, and then Rhiannon over Zoom, who are going to provide the update this evening.
So we have a Lugami PowerPoint. They're going first.
I think Rhiannon's going first.
Yeah.
Oh, Rhiannon's going first.
Oh, we're going to do the other one, DLCD? Okay.
All right. Ready? Let me see if I can share my screen here, and then we can go ahead and get going. Okay, can you all see that as large screen?
Yep.
Full screen?
Sure
can. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you all for having us tonight to talk about Joaquin Beaches and Dunes, and as John will talk about, the inventory maps as well. My name is Aninza Zor, and I'm the Coastal Shore Specialist with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, which also houses the Oregon Coastal Management Program. And just as a quick reminder, the OCMP is a partner network, and so we partner with the counties, with the cities, as well as with other state agencies. And then we cover the entire coastal zone, so all 362 miles of coastline, as well as the major estuaries. And it extends all the way into the coastal watershed and out to the territorial sea as well. And as part of the OCMP, within DLCD, we cover the coastal goals. So just as a quick reminder, goal 16 is estuarine resources, goal 17, coastal shorelands. I'm going to move my window here. Goal 18, to which we'll be talking about today, beaches and dunes, and then goal 19 covers ocean resources. And this is just kind of a not great diagram, kind of highlighting each of these different areas for what the different goals cover. And so again, goal 16, 17, 18, and 19 here, and goal 18, beaches and dunes, which is the focus of today. Goal 18, guides the protection and development of beach and dune areas. The main provisions of Goal 18 include prohibition areas for development, so mostly those apply to high hazard areas, as well as very sensitive landforms, such as on active beaches and dunes. It also calls for the preservation of dune vegetation, because that can provide a lot of stability for dune sand, and it can then provide protection for the homes and communities behind those dunes too. It also lays out the requirements for dune grading, including that four dune management plans have to be formally adopted in order to have any sort of view grading or dune grading other than remedial grading, or the removal of sand that's actually inundating and, you know, causing harm to a building, or and present or preventing access to that structure. And then Goyetine is also pretty well known for the limitations on beachfront protective structures, or BPS for short. And so the requirement for that is that any development that was, any lot that was developed prior to January 1st, 1977 can be eligible for Goal 18 for beachfront protective structures, and anything that was developed after that is not eligible for beachfront protective structures. And then one of the third provisions, which is the reason why we're here tonight, it calls for an inventory of beach and dune areas to be formally adopted by each jurisdiction. So each of these inventories also it needs a map, but also needs to describe the stability, the movement, groundwater resources, hazard values of those beach and dune areas. And so these inventories and the maps that are part of them really help guide these other provisions, because it tells you where those areas are, where you should and shouldn't let development occur. Sorry, my puppy is biting my hand. Sorry, just trying to multitask here. And again, one of the main aims of Goal 18 is to limit armoring. So again, development for the existence of development refers to houses, commercial or industrial buildings, or vacant but improved subdivision lots. And some of the shoreline armoring cons include that it can limit beach access not only north-south, but also east and west. So if it extends out, like riprap, as you can see in this picture, if it extends out far onto the beach during high tide or king tide or storms, that can limit access to the beach and along the beach. It also alters the natural landscape. It can break the link between the land and the sea and those ecosystems. It can disrupt or stop altogether sediment cycles for those specific areas. That can really limit a lot of sediment to the beaches. And there are a lot of aesthetic issues as well. And armoring, as I'm sure you all know, is permitted for, via OPRD most of the time, because it's located on the public beach. But local governments do permit when it's located east of the public beach. And so I know OPRD is really working on a lot of coordination between those two jurisdictions. One of the resources that we have available from DLCD is our coastal atlas, and the URL is down here below. And so this includes a lot of great information on here from Lugani and FEMA. But it also has the jurisdictional boundaries from OPRD, and it also has the Goal 18 eligibility too. If anything in green, these lots are considered eligible, and then in red, not eligible. And just as a reminder, eligibility is only the first step for shoreline armoring. It just determines whether or not a permit can even be considered for armoring. So Oregon Parks and Rec, of course, is the steward for the ocean shore. Permits for ocean shore alterations don't just happen for beachfront protective structures, but also for other alterations and activities on the ocean shore, such as beach access ways, dune grading, pipeline and cables, which is becoming an increasing issue along the coast, and natural product removal as well. And these also require local government sign-off and compliance with the land use goals.
May I interrupt?
You were speaking just a moment ago. I'll go back to the slide here so I use natural product removal. Are you talking about sand?
It can be sand, it could also be driftwood, rock. So OPRD, I won't speak too much for them because I don't know their roles quite as well, but they do have a limit on how much natural products can be removed. It can't be for a commercial amount. It can be what is considered personal amount, for personal use.
So people walking up my trail with armloads of driftwood, that's permissible, but if they're pulling it in a cart, it's not. I mean, I see it the week later at the market,
but they can't sell it.
It's kind of commercial to me, but Just curious, yeah, but you can't resell it, so when you go to the farmer's market, you see all these mobiles and things, driftwood in them, technically those are illegal, because you're reselling things you picked up off the beach. But if you want to put a few dock bodies in the front yard.
Maybe they picked the driftwood up down in California.
Well, that's very possible. My wife has done that.
Well, my theory was it was always easier to get forgiveness than permission.
And I reckon that is one of the harder to patrol and enforce parts of OPRD's job. I know the beach rangers are out there and they're keeping an eye on these things, but you know, as we know, 362 miles and we only have so many rangers. So I can imagine that they have a hard time enforcing that one, definitely.
I'm sorry to go back, but now that we started this, I'm back on the slides, might be number 20. But the one that says statewide planning goal 18, beaches and dunes. The statement that armoring
that
is...
That one or the tree?
Sorry?
That one?
Sorry, this one right here?
That one. That second to last bullet. That almost sounds like the default is permission, but I thought it was restricted to these 1977 and prior.
I thought it was more restricted than that.
So, can you explain why that says permitted most of the time?
Yeah. So, I think that is worded poorly, and I apologize for that. So, I mean that they are responsible for permitting those applications for those types of projects. And most of the time, I'm referring to that most of those projects do occur on the ocean shore, so they do fall under OPRD's jurisdiction, so they would need an OPRD permit. Sometimes those beachfront protected structures do occur east of the statutory vegetation line, which is their jurisdictional line, and so in those cases, the local government would be responsible for the permit. And sometimes, if it crosses both sides, then those permits would be needed for both.
Okay, but it still doesn't override the 1977 thing.
No, yeah, sorry, so I don't, yeah.
Okay.
By permitted, I didn't mean it's permissible in most cases, I just mean that they are responsible for issuing the permit.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, yeah. All right, any other questions before we move on? And if you think of anything, please stop me along the way. I'm happy to answer. Okay, and we have a number of Goal 18 kind of focused resources or that have Goal 18 implications that DLCD has published recently over the last few years. And one of these is a guidebook on erosion control practices of the Oregon coast. This is a really great resource. It has information on what is and isn't permissible, eligibility requirements. It has information on different types of beachfront protective structures, as well as more nature-based natural solutions that would be great for either properties that are not eligible for Goal 18 or in areas that maybe a hardened structure isn't necessarily needed, but some type of erosion control could be needed. So maybe something like a cobble revetment, like in this picture here, might be an appropriate solution. And so this is a really great resource. We also have the Sea Level Rise Planning Guide. And so this has a lot of really important information in terms of how communities and especially planning departments can help implement sea level rise planning into their comprehensive plans, into their code, as well as kind of give you an idea of what to expect and how to perform really equitable and great community engagement around the topic of sea level rise as well. We also have the Tsunami Land Use Guide. This is definitely applicable in the beach and dune overlay zone, as well as for Newport, of course, most a great deal of Newport. It's also, you know, most of the tsunami and sea level rise inundation zones are fairly overlapping in a lot of cases, and so things that help prepare for tsunamis also help prepare for sea level rise in the future. So that's another really great resource. We also have a coastal public access guide that includes model code for public access. There's also a mapping exercise that was created for this, so there are new coastal public access maps available that can be adopted as well. And then more specific to Goal 18, coming soon, we're trying to get this through our communications team before we publish it. We've been working on the Oregon Beaches and Dunes Land Use Guide. So we have model language for how to update Goal 18 and comprehensive plans and adopting the updated maps that John will talk about shortly. We also have model language for coastal hazards overlay zones. And this model language has been used so far by Tillamook, and Clackett County has borrowed some of it, and Coos County and the City of Bandon have also used this model language. They're currently going through the process of Goal 18 updates too, and adopting the maps that John will show you. And it also provides guidance for incorporating sea level rise and climate change too.
I have a question. With sea level rise, it's probably a gradual thing. I probably won't be here when it really hits, but as that occurs, and if I have property that was not before 1977, is there provisions to allow me to do some armoring, or that's like, we're, it's not going to happen because it was after 1977.
Yeah, in those cases, non-structural solutions such as dynamic revetments, cobble berms, sand nourishment, other types of non-structural, so no like riprap or seawalls, but other non-structural solutions can be a good option in those cases. There are also certain areas where jurisdictions have applied or single entities have applied for exceptions to Goal 18. Those are really time and cost intensive, so they are not common, and they kind of go against the goal, the aim of Goal 18. But that erosion control guidebook does offer a lot of great solutions for non-Goal 18 eligible properties.
As you guys developed this, did you contact some other areas in the United States that is seeing sea level rise to help you come up with your solutions? They got sea level rise issues in South Florida, mm-hmm. for example. They also have big time erosion issues on the Alabama and North Carolina, which I'm very familiar with. And different localities come up with stuff, but I'm just wondering whether or not Oregon went and had some conversation with what's going on in South Florida.
I'm not sure if they talked to anyone from Florida. The sea level guide was published right before I started with DLCD, so I'm not sure exactly who they talked to, but I do believe that they at least talked to people from California and Washington. I know that as we update that along the way, we've been in contact with people from those states as well too, and I think that they also definitely took a look at other states and what they were doing, and it's something that we are really looking more into in the future, because as you know, I mean, these are all like pretty ongoing emerging topics. And so I think it's kind of a group effort and see what's working other places and not thinking that, you know, we're in a silo that Oregon has to figure out everything by ourselves. We can definitely borrow from other people's experiences.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Question? Not way back on your first or second slide. Second slide with that little map on it of the various zones.
And it says territorial sea, 0 to 3 miles. Is that, is the definition of territorial sea geographical and not political? And is there a distinction between that definition and state jurisdiction versus federal jurisdiction?
Yes, so it does extend out to 3 miles offshore, and that positional boundary is at that 3 mile line.
Okay.
Between state and federal.
So this area just represents shallow water, essentially, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so a lot of things that, you know, state has control over occur in these areas, things that are coming up, like offshore wind, you know, other topics like that. Cable landings that are extending onshore will occur in these areas. And so those are all things that the state has say over. And then we do at the LCD, we have a federal consistency coordinator who makes sure that whatever the federal entities are doing with a territorial sea are in compliance with state law.
Okay. And vice versa. Thank you.
So with that, I believe I'm done. I can take any other questions, and then John will speak more about those maps, and you get to see them, some really cool updates in the work that they've been doing.
Right,
so I'll stop sharing here and take any questions.
I have one more question.
Please.
So you mentioned Tillamook County, and it made me think of Director Hampshire and working through their sort of land use processes for new development along the coast. There's, you know, we deal with like ocean setback lines. That's really clear and defined for me. I can draw a line and know exactly where I need to be there. Our geologists give us like a setback, and again, really clear, they'll draw a line and we know we can't go beyond that. I've always had a lot of trouble with the non-aquatic vegetation line. It's something that we have to comply with, and it's something that's so ambiguous. So I'm curious if there are best practices. I know right now what we do is I hire a third-party surveyor to go out and mark it, because I'm like, I don't know what else to do to accurately, you know, if I go out there and map it, then I have a like obvious bias because I'm trying to represent my clients and arguably get them as close to the ocean as I can. Are there other better ways to do that?
One thing I want to clarify, are you referring to the statutory vegetation line for OPRD's jurisdiction?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you can also check with OPRD as well, too. A survey is generally required for their applications for permits. So between that and checking with OPRD as well, too, to make sure that whatever is surveyed is matching up with their inventory's statutory vegetation line or where the actual vegetation line is, whichever is being used, is probably the best practice.
So one follow-up question. It changes, right? And that's the thing that I've always had trouble with, because, you know, I'll be on a beachfront site and suddenly there's, like, where we had mapped grass, the grass is now covered in sand. And I'm like, oh, I don't see grass anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it changes, does it need to be updated or no?
No. Okay. So the statutory vegetation line, which is established in 1967, is a fixed line.
Could you come up?
Sorry.
Yes. Thank you.
So the statutory vegetation line is a fixed line that was established by ODOT surveyors in 1967. And so if the coast actually retreats, then the vegetation line becomes whatever is present at the time that it's been eroded, right? So if the statutory vegetation line erodes 50 feet, then that is the new regulation that you have to map to. If the shoreline advances 50 feet and new vegetation grows seaward of the original vegetation line, the original vegetation line still applies.
So you lose, you don't win. Yeah, you don't gain.
That's correct. Yeah. You don't gain.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
I have a question. I think it's called the Longshore Transport. It moves stuff from north to south. That's a natural way to do it.
Sure.
And I noticed your historical and your aerial images of 1939, 1967, and 2022. I imagine that's because of the Longshore Transport, where it's eliminating some of the beach line and coastal areas.
Sure.
Is there going to be anything done to refurbish that, like dredging and putting it into that, into those areas that have eroded because of the transport?
So those are all options, and I think that goes back to your question about engineering solutions dealing with sea level rise. So, you know, in terms of engineering the coast, there are what we call hard engineering solutions, which are things yes. like riprap, seawalls, gabion walls, sheet piling, things like that. In the soft engineering that Rhiannon was referring to, which are what we call cobble beaches, using vegetation with sand and behind and things like that, even using flotsam that, you know, is present on beaches. You know, you're talking about removing woody debris from beaches. That woody debris, especially if it's in abundance, actually provides significant protection because it actually traps sand and allows dunes to build up and things like that. So that's one of the reasons why there's a, you know, prohibition against removing large volumes of woody debris from the beach environment. So there are other solutions that can be applied, which is things like dredging and then taking that dredge spoil and placing it directly on the beach. The problem with that is that it's the only entity that's doing active dredging on the Oregon coast is the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for the navigation channels. And they're required by the federal government to dispose of that sediment in the least cost manner, which is typically 100 feet water depth directly offshore the mouth of the bays. So in order for you to actually grab that sand, you're going to have to pay for it through either the state or local or, you know, whoever. So unfortunately, there is virtually no sand renourishment that occurs on the Oregon coast for two reasons. One is we don't have an adequate source of sediment, and the second one is it's very expensive. I mean, the cost of doing beach renourishment on the Florida coastline is immense. We're talking tens of millions of dollars to, you know, rebuild a beach that's destroyed in a hurricane. And then it's, you know, good for one winter, and then it gets destroyed by the next.
That's
winter.
What happens because of the transport.
Yeah.
But it's kind of alarming when you look at the 1939 to 1967 to 2022.
Well, actually, that image is actually is a positive one, because what you see is the area adjacent to the south jetty at Yucuna Bay here has actually gained sand. But that sand is obviously coming from somewhere else, and that somewhere else is further south down towards Yahats, because that's an area that we're actually seeing pretty active erosion. There's a lot of accretion going on up against LC Spit there, and then there's a lot of accretion going on up against the jetties here in Newport. And then also actually on the north side up by Agger Beach, close to Yucuna Head there. And that's all a function of cycles of sand movement, you know, the longshore drift that you're referring to. And that's all driven by climate events. You know, these could be storms. It could also be larger climate cycles. The El Nino Southern Oscillation is probably one of the most significant forcing mechanisms of sand movement on this coast.
Thank you.
Sure.
So I'll just wrap up my section here by saying, just so I hear if you can see this, these are some options for non-eligible properties, like sunset beach nourishment in Oregon is not a very common solution. And non-tropical solutions must use biodegradable materials, not reflect wave energy, and not include any structural elements. And I will say, too, that Senate Bill 504, just recently passed, is guiding GLCD to go through rulemaking process to define nature-based non-structural solutions and provide some guidance for local jurisdictions on how to use that in their code. And so it is kind of an evolving definition that we will definitely be in touch with everybody once that rulemaking process has wrapped up, and that will be by end of 2026, I believe. And then I will just show this one slide to help answer that previous question. So the statutory vegetation line here in this 1967 box, you can see is actually westward of the 2022 actual vegetation line, a line of actual vegetation. And so the ocean shore is the land line between extreme low tide and the statutory vegetation line, or the line of established upland vegetation, whichever is farther inland. So in some cases where there's been accretion, this line of established upland vegetation might actually be westward of the 1967 line. In a lot of cases, we see that it is eastward. And so anything that lies between the land, either the natural vegetation line or the line of upland vegetation to low tide, extreme low tide, is OPRD's jurisdiction.
Anybody have any further questions? Okay, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, next up with the Coastal Dune Hazard Map update, we have Bill Donnelly.
All right, let's share it.
And could you tell me your name again?
Sure. So my name is John Allen. I'm a coastal geomorphologist with the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. I've lived here in Newport since 2000. So I'm a resident here. I've been researching Oregon coastal processes for the last two decades. I work very closely with scientists at Oregon State University. And I've studied beaches, storms, engineering, all that sort of stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you all today about some recent work that Rhiannon just introduced in terms of doing this updated mapping of beach and dune inventories for Lincoln County. This work is actually really covering the entire Oregon coast. But of course, you know, what we're talking about here today is just specific to the Newport area. Next slide, please.
Sorry. Okay. That's faster than I thought. Sorry. There we go.
So, for those of you who don't know Dogami, the Oregon Department of Geology, the agency has been around since the 1930s. We're split into two divisions. We have a mine land reclamation program that, you know, deals with all the mining and then post mining cleanup, etc. I'm not going to talk about them. And then there's the Geologic Survey and Services, which is what I'm part of, the group that I'm part of. And so I'm going to address mainly the work associated with GS&S, which is the Geologic Survey. So we have, really within the GSS, we have six core areas focused on earthquake hazards, landslide inventory and hazard mapping, flood and channel migration, tsunami and coastal erosion, which is my group. We also do geologic mapping and mineral exploration activities and evaluation. And then sort of underpinning all the work that we do is our airborne LIDAR program, where we actually collect remotely sensed information about the landscape, and we compile that information, which is then used by local government agencies, scientists, etc., to look at the features of the landscape itself. And so that really, the LIDAR program really underpins everything that we do in terms of mapping, etc. I'll touch on that a little bit more very shortly. So my group is really focused on coastal processes, coastal hazards. We've worked on it, like I said before, we worked on the Oregon coast for almost two decades. We've produced all the erosion hazard maps that you all use here in Newport, and obviously with Lincoln County as a whole. We've developed all the updated FEMA flood coastal maps for the entire county and the coast. We've done all the tsunami hazard mapping work, etc. So we've, you know, we have a very strong interest and strong background in geologic processes on the Oregon coast and in the Newport area specifically. Next slide. So where this all started was that in the 1970s, the Oregon Coastal Conservation and Development Commission at the time requested that the U.S. Department of Soil and Conservation, U.S. Soil Conservation Development Agriculture, to develop an inventory of beaches and dunes on the Oregon coast. And this was work that was started in 1972 and eventually completed in 1975. Basically, the approach they took was to do a combination of using aerial imagery, where they looked at that under stereo microscopes, mapped the landscape, identifying dune features, and then they also did extensive field work to verify development of soils and other factors. And all of that is summarized in this very comprehensive report. The image on the right that you see up there is a map of the southern part of Newport. The very top of the screen there is the South Beach area, and then extending south down towards Seal Rock there. And so the maps that they produced were these paper maps from which planners would have to make decisions as they related to Goal 18. And within that map there, they identified a whole suite of features that included things like actual beaches, fore dunes, active fore dunes, coastal terraces, old parabolic dunes, and various other features that may have implications from a planning standpoint. So these original maps are part of this very comprehensive report, and they're used by coastal planners as part of their overlay zone for making decisions as it relates to Goal 18, as Rhiannon described before. So, you know, basically, local jurisdictions must adopt this beach and dune overlay zone as part of their comprehensive planning, and that's used, as Rhiannon indicated, to manage ocean shores. That's basically its primary purpose. So these maps were actually then digitized in 2016 by the Department of Land Conservation Development, but they're still maps that were produced, you know, almost 4 or 5 decades ago. So these are old maps. And as we all know and appreciate, you know, the Oregon coast has actually changed quite dramatically in the last 4 or 5 decades. And so we, with DLCD's help, have been trying to find the funding to actually update these maps and modernize them effectively. Next slide. So you're going to be able to read it, but the table up on the left there, it's probably in your packages there, but the table on the left there describes the original 1975 classification that the U.S. Department of Ag came up with. So these were the active fore dunes, active dune hummocks, recently stabilized fore dunes, dune complexes, and many other different categories there. There's a second column to the right, which is the DLCD classification, and that column there is specific to Goal 18. So while there are a bunch of other features that have been identified in this mapping, it is only the ones that are defined in that second column to the right there, identified as DLCD classification, that apply with respect to Goal 18. And so those are the ones that really, from a planning statement standpoint, those are the ones that are most significant, and that's what I'm going to touch on. So the map on the right there is a geospatial sort of compilation of the original mapping that was done in 1975. And you can immediately see that things have changed in that map. That map there is showing you the South Beach area, so south of Newquinta Bay. You can see examples of large areas of open sand. There's no actual beach that's defined in that map there. There's what they're terming as recently stabilized, stabilized dune sand, which is the DS, or the green there. And then there's much older deposits which are built on top of marine terraces, what they define as older dune sand deposits, or the ODS and brown there. And then there's other features like fill that makes up the Hatfield Marine Science Center and things like that. Next slide.
John, can we go back to that slide?
Sure.
I was just curious, so in areas like McLean Point, is that difference in the dark outline versus the red, is that just more accurate mapping, or has anything actually changed?
So things have definitely changed,
okay.
And it's really a function of more accurate mapping.
Okay.
So So keep in mind, when they were doing this mapping, they're using stereo images and looking through a microscope and then drawing on paper maps.
Yeah.
Without actually seeing the underlying ground. So they're seeing the vegetation on top, but the stereo imagery is not able to penetrate through the vegetation to see the underlying ground, the bare earth, like what we call it. So that's kind of a great example. What you're looking at there is all that structure, that roughness in that image there is the bare earth that we see and we're able to determine in light. So yes, big changes in the mapping plus improvements. Next slide. So I alluded to this. The reason for updating this is because much has changed on the Oregon coast. And really, you know, a lot of these changes can be summarized into sort of five thematic areas. These include the expansion of European beach grass, which was first introduced on the Oregon coast in the 1900s. It really started to expand very rapidly in the 1940s. It was planted extensively, mainly up in Clatsop County and down in Coos County. But of course, it's easily spread by birds and through erosion processes. And it's very efficient and pretty hard wearing in terms of being able to become established in dunes and then grow from there.
So we've all seen European beech grass is not a
it's not a native
invasive
grass.
No,
it's an invasive grass.
Is it deemed invasive?
It is an invasive. I'm not sure it's deemed invasive, but it's a tough grass.
Yeah, I know.
It is very hard to kill European beech grass.
Right.
And I would say that it's not unique to the Oregon coast. You'll find it on the East Coast, you'll find it in Australia, you'll find it in New Zealand. It came from Europe. It's all over the place.
But we also have, I don't want to say it's American beech grass.
We do, yeah. There's actually, I think it's called Breville galata, which is that's actually another introduced species that came from the Great Lakes. It has a broader blade on the grass. And it's very effective at actually trapping sand as well. But it produces a very different dune morphology. So European beech grass builds very tall dunes. So you can see this down at South Beach there at the State Park. Breville galata builds a much broader, lower dune. And you see evidence of this like up in the Clatsop Plains where it's more prominent up there. And particularly up on the Washington coast. We also have a native species grass that is being basically pushed out by these other species.
Okay, thank you.
What about pampas grass?
Not on the beaches, not on the dunes. I'm not aware of that particular species.
That's okay.
Okay.
Yeah, you've seen patches of it.
Okay.
Everywhere, but a little more inland.
Okay.
You see it in my lot.
Primarily, everywhere.
Okay. So the other major changes, of course, is shoreline changes around the jetties themselves. I mean, the best example of this is obviously Newport here, Yucuna Bay, with the amount of dune growth. And you can see that in that image up on the screen there, or the south side of Yucuna Bay where the state park is. All of that vegetated area, the sort of lighter green grass area there, is all as a result of sand buildup against the south jetty there, again due to longshore transport of sediment along the coastline. Other factors, things like building on fore dunes, that's a great example there, the south beach area. And then of course changes of beach dune morphology, this is being driven by storms. So what we're talking about is the erosion of beaches and dunes, but also in other areas like Pacific City, you may actually get dune growth as a result of sand movement. And then, lastly, because of expansion of coastal engineering. So the work that we did here is really funded through a grant that was supplied by the National Ocean Atmospheric Administration, the Coastal Service Center, through a special merit study, and we are grateful for their funding to support this work. Next slide. So how did we go about doing the work? And I've already alluded to this. So obviously a major part of the mapping work is really based around terrestrial LIDAR. And here's three examples spanning from 2009, 2016, and 2020 of a bare earth image of the South Beach area. And the 2009 LiDAR was actually flown by my agency as part of a seed grant through the state legislature, and then actually in partnership with Lincoln County, Chipton as well, we were able to cover a very substantial part of coastal Oregon, but also inland areas as well. And really, again, it's, you know, been such a breakthrough in terms of doing geologic hazard mapping work. In 2016, that LiDAR was flown by the Corps of Engineers, and again in 2020. And so the mapping there, you know, really starts to pop out a number of different features. You can see, obviously, the active beach line, the foredune, but you can also see evidence of older dune deposits landward of the actual ocean beach itself. And then the 2020 LiDAR is even more phenomenal because that is actually is a bathy topo LiDAR. So if the conditions are good, the LiDAR can actually penetrate through the water column and then begin to pick up the underlying nearshore bars and features like that. So we use these data as part of our mapping.
I'm gonna make a note that we have 15 minutes left and we do have another work session item still tonight.
I'll go fast.
Thank you.
Next slide. So we also do, we also utilized historical aerial imagery. So again, we have imagery from 1939 of the first flight of the entire Oregon coast taken in January of 1939. 1967 was used to derive the Oregon Beach Bill and the statutory vegetation line. And then it is a contemporary image in 2022. And you can't really see it there, but maybe in your package you can see the different shoreline positions over time. And right up against that south jetty there, you can see how the beach has actually advanced seaward by several hundred feet. Next slide. We utilize other types of data sets in the mapping, including the Statewide Landslide Information Database, which is known as SLIDO, the Oregon Geologic Data Compilation, which is basically detailed geologic maps, and then all the plethora of studies that have been done by myself and many other colleagues looking at coastal hazards in the Newport and Lincoln County area. So all that information is then fed into the actual mapping itself. Next slide. So specific to the Newport, so the image on the left shows the original mapping that was done in 1965, and the image on the right is the latest mapping that we've completed. And you know what you see here is that the first thing to notice is that what's defined as ODS, or older dunes, sands, is basically synonymous with what we define as coastal terraces. Wherever you see ODS deposits, they're invariably forming on top of these coastal terraces. These are very old sand deposits that are on the order of tens of thousands of years old. And so they're typically highly vegetated, stabilized beaches. What you don't see on the left image is you don't see any definition of a beach per se. On the right you do. We also identify other features like landslides. And then of course, critical from the standpoint of Goal 18 is identification of foredunes and active foredunes and other types of foredune deposits, which are in this map here primarily in the area, in that little triangle there on the north side of the North Jetty. Next slide. So this is a similar sort of map, but this is specific to the South Beach area. And again, you can see on the left there, the 1975 mapping, which shows large areas of open sand in the South Beach area. In the new mapping, all that open sand is now gone. It's basically been stabilized by European beach grass, development of the South Beach campground, development, etc. So, you know, lots of modifications. But within the image on the right there, you can see also evidence of those older foredune sequences that would have been certainly pre-jetty times, and probably actually extending back several thousand years, going back to about when sea level was approaching its present day levels, about 5,000 years ago. And so that whole Newport South Beach, Yucuna Bay area would have been in a vastly different environment, you know, with large shoaling going on, probably extending all the way south towards it's hard to sort of point on here. where Highway 101 leaves the South Beach area as it goes up on top of the Marine Terraces, you know, basically extending as far south as there. Next slide. And this is just a sort of more close-up view of the two areas. The one on the left is obviously the South Beach area. In pink is the, I just really highlighted the active foredune, and that extends north up into along Nye Beach all the way up to the creek there, and then obviously the other features.
And I think that's probably about it in terms of the mapping. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any quick questions? Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Fantastic information. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we only got about 10 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
So
our next
item. I don't know whether or not we want to have Mr. John or push him back.
Well, we got him here, so I think you can do it pretty quickly. And we will only have 2B this evening. We aren't going to do item 2C. So he will be our last agenda item for the work session.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's just John left.
My mom always says that. There you go, boost night for me, guys.
There you go.
How's everybody doing?
Since you're here, you're lighting up the whole...
I don't believe that one bit.
It's the reflection.
Oh, it's a reflection. Humorous.
I appreciate that. So sharing it?
Okay.
There we go.
There you go.
So I'll be very quick and brief. Derek wanted me to pop in, just give you guys an update as where we're at on the website. So right now we're about 90% of the way built out. With it, we're still working on some smaller things. A couple of those are within the community development area, making sure we get the public records search transfer over and into a good place. And that's kind of on our current website. We feel like that's a pretty important piece to the new website as well, and something that the community is going to want on there. But I wanted to give you a quick glimpse of what the current community development page looks like. Right now, just you can kind of see everything's just kind of on there and thrown on there. It's not very easy to find everything. Sorry, Jerry.
I didn't do it.
It's not very easy to find any of the info you're trying to find, most likely out of the planning department here at the city of Newport. So what we wanted to do with the new website across all departments, not just planning, is to kind of streamline that process, make it easier for people. One thing to remember about government websites is that the goal of government websites is very different than the goal of pretty much any other website in existence. Whether you're talking about CNN, ESPN, YouTube, whatever, they want to keep you on their site forever. That's their rule. We want you to find the info you want and get out. And it's really that simple. We're not trying to get you lost in our website and keep you down a rabbit hole within there. So. We'll go here, and this is kind of what our design is looking like right now, our main website. This would be our main homepage. Still working on the main photo within there. I think I kind of like that, but we'll see how it plays off. We'll have, these are called quick links right down here. I'm waiting for Jim to laugh, but he hasn't. These are called quick links down here. Where people can get to kind of the quickest information that we feel like the community is going to want to come to when they're coming to our website. But within that, we also have these drop-down menus right here that'll get you pretty much everywhere else. So this will get you to our city council and all the info about them, our various committees within here, and then even our departments. And city staff. One other thing we're still working on is transferring over the committee pages and making those cleaner than they currently are. So those are two of probably my bigger things that I'm working on along with the search function for the records through planning.
Hey, John?
Yes?
I don't know, it's really up to me not to. If you want to say a quick link, that somebody can click on so that they can send a question in to be answered by the city.
We have, yeah, we have a contact us page within here, so, and various things. We do, on our current site, it's kind of a weird, it's a form, and then you have to hit a drop down that gives you every option under the sun to send to, and sometimes people send to the wrong option, people send it, so we wanted to streamline that process. So we do have a separate form for city council to reach out to us. We have separate contacts for different departments, stuff like that as well. So hopefully making that process a little bit easier for people to be able to find the people they try to, they're going to try to get to. So I'm going to go over the community development page now and where we're kind of lying within here. And we'll also put some specific contact infos on here over most likely on the left side, but possibly up in this area as well. Where you see it.
Bless you. Thank you. Sorry.
Fully agree. Fully agree. Well,
the presentation we just saw had a map viewer. Could that be included here? Because it looked like it had some tremendous information.
Yeah, for about $50,000 more, we could probably add in such technology onto a website. So.
Well, I don't mean their technology. I mean just a link viewer.
Well, yeah, we could easily link to that stuff. Yeah, that
would be a good resource, I think. I'm going to go home and try it.
We can do stuff like that, and it's easy to add on. I mean, Derek wanted these interactive web maps on here currently as well, and we could easily add in other stuff like that as well. So that would be.
Do we have a link to the Google Meet as viewer?
We probably do.
I'm not sure on our current site. I would have no idea. If we do, good luck finding it. And let me know the path that you took to get there to find it, if you do. But we could certainly do that within there, and that would make it a little bit easier. And then this came through multiple meetings with Derek and his team as well, just how they would like the site map to kind of lay out for the development department. So you kind of have your main areas over here, and then, you know, then we break it down into a few of these have their own separate site. One thing we do have, the municipal code is in probably 5 or 6 different places on our website. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that stood out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And people had access, and especially with what the new municipal code website looks like. I assume you have all been on there, but it's a really great tool, a really great feature to get in there, and our team worked really hard to, you know, find that stuff. So you can search anything, and it comes up within seconds to get you to the info you need on the municipal code.
So this is integrated into your website, or it takes you to a new window?
It takes you to a new website, but keeps your window open for our website as well. So it opens up a new browser window for you, and then gets you onto that. But this is hosted through a different place and not through our current website. Right. So different. Municode is who hosts it, so it's all on their site and within their program, within there. We also have a few areas like this where there's a lot of long lists that are, you know, put down on our current site. So we wanted to make that a little bit easier for people to find, you know, the checklist that they need to find. So you can come down and you just view it by the area. And then hit that scroll down real quick, and then the extra ones will come up for it. And if you click a different one, the other one closes, so you don't create some long scrolling list in front of you. It's a little bit easier to find a lot of the info you're gonna try to get to. Is there anything specific in here you guys wanted me to show off for you or see where we're at?
What? Is this on a test system?
This is on a backdoor website right now, yeah. So we still
have to. Is there any way we could link to it when we have some time to get through it and then send you notes?
No.
Okay.
When we go to external testing, then I can include you guys in that if you'd like. Okay. And we can work on that. But at this time, no. We're still finishing out the build. We'll do some internal testing. Then we'll go to external. But again, once we do that, we're still going to need you to not share the link or anything like that. But I could certainly send it to you guys if you wanted to be included in that process.
I for one would like it, yeah.
Yep.
Beta test?
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm going to send it to Bob. Dude's just going to send it. 10,000 spelling.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So planning commission, meeting agendas, where would those be on this page?
We can certainly link that within here.
Will they just be like they are now, where they're on the homepage once they're posted?
Yeah, it'll look a little bit, yeah, it'll certainly look a little bit different when we do that. But otherwise, if you want to get to our committee page, you can go up to your government here, get into any of those committee pages.
Click on planning commission.
It just looks the same right now, essentially, as it is. So we're going to change that out.
Oh, okay.
But right now, it just looks exactly the same as it currently is. But I could easily put that onto the planning page as well. Yeah.
Are you ready to wrap it up?
I was wrapped up 7 minutes ago.
One more question. Okay. Consternation in the chair. One more question. So for the auto contact, where you can, like what you have now, where you have the drop down, mm-hmm. and you can pick who you want to send a note to, and it gets triaged by someone. So will
that is going away.
So that's going away.
That's going away.
Completely.
Yes.
Okay. So I would look for the, will it be an email address for contact people then on each page?
Each department will have general email addresses mm-hmm. for each department. I went through a lot of city government websites and everyone kind of does it different. Right. But what I was seeing across the board more and more were just general emails for departments more than anything else that on our end goes to the correct people within those departments.
Yeah,
and multiple people
staff changes, but yeah. At least you get a generic one that's the same on the site.
Yeah, okay. there's a couple reasons for that. I mean, we have, you know, over a couple hundred employees here, and sometimes putting a full staff listing, a lot of people can get lost when they're just trying to find, you know, who do I email, you know. So just getting it to the department, it's in the right hands at that point, and someone will respond. So we have a couple emails that are already doing that. Like our Public Works has an admin email where the email it goes to like four different people in the department, and when they respond, everyone else sees that someone else responded. So that's what we're setting up for most of our departments. Police so far is the only one who requested individual emails for all of their.
What about a staff directory? Will that be there somewhere?
No. Just the leadership. Number one, we have so many new staff coming in. Blame HR. We have so many new staff coming in on a regular basis. It's tough to keep those updated, honestly, especially a full staff directory. But we do have a leadership page that'll show the heads of each department. So if you want to get to those departments.
Just email me now. There you go.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ford.